Welcome back to the show. I'm Travis Chappell, and I believe that if you can connect with the best, you can become the best. So after creating 800 podcast episodes about building your network, I've come to realize that networking is really just making friends, if you're doing it the right way anyway. Join me as I make friends with world-class athletes like Shaquille O'Neal, entertainers like Rob Dyrdek, authors like Dr. Nicole LaPera, former presidents like Vicente Fox, or even the occasional FBI hostage negotiator, billionaire real estate mogul, or polarizing political figure. So if you want to make more friends that help you become a better version of yourself, then subscribe to the show and keep on listening, because this is Travis Makes Friends. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the show. Today, I'm making friends with Dia Sims. Dia is the CEO of Lobos 1707 Tequila and Mezcal, a new independent spirits brand that launched back in 2020 with backing by some major celebrity names like LeBron James. Before that, Dia spent almost 15 years working alongside Sean Diddy Combs at Combs Enterprises, working her way from executive assistant all the way to becoming president of all of Combs Enterprises, where she oversaw multi-billion dollar brands under the Combs empire. Most notably, she led Ciroc Premium Vodka from being nothing really, from launch all the way through to having a $2 billion retail value. She's been called one of the most powerful executives in the industry by Billboard, named to Ebony Power 100 list, and a woman to watch by Ad Age. But today, I'm glad to call her my friend. Here is my conversation with the one and only Dia Sims.
Dia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
Man, I appreciate you being willing to sit down. I know you're in Vegas for a short trip. How's the trip been?
It's been great out here pushing, slinging tequila and whisking a variety of incredible, delicious treats.
Yeah, I'm a fan.
Good. Yeah. I love to hear that. Yeah. Why don't we have a bottle of tequila here? That's a poor decision.
Good, I literally told him.
Real miss.
10 minutes before we sat down, I was like,
I swung by Mr. Lee's. I could have been a better person. Yeah, my bad.
Damn. Well, I'll enjoy some later on my own.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, we'll enjoy some in spirit.
Do a virtual toast. Yeah, there we go. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, listen, Dia, I was super excited to chat with you. I think the first time I saw your stuff was when you were doing a panel at an event that I was at in LA. 4 years ago, years ago.
No, it was Mastermind, I think.
Yeah, Mastermind. Yes. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Amelia was just like, man, she's got an awesome story. So I went, followed your stuff, and then recently reached out and was just like, we need to finally have this conversation. So
overdue.
I want to go back in time because I love
stock tips. No.
yes, primarily. Yeah, mainly to put some money in Bitcoin.
There you go.
2010. Yeah. But I want to build some context for those listening because you're now the CEO of Lobos Tequila, which is a massive tequila brand backed by people like LeBron James, if anybody knows who that is. The path that you took, this is why I love doing this show. Because I like to showcase different paths, more unconventional paths, like when people do something that's wildly different and it ends up going very well for them. And that's what we like to talk about on the show. So let's go back in time. Tell me about 8-year-old Dia Sims.
8-year-old.
Set the scene.
Yes. So 8 years old, I think. My father was in the army, so I moved around a little bit. Born in California, and then we lived in. I'm old enough that I lived in West Germany, which you may not know about.
Oh wow!
And then we came.
I've
back
heard
to,
about it.
You heard about it. You
read
about history.
Read a thing or two. Yeah.
There you go. and then we came back to New York, and so I had to kind of get used to. Like I remember my parents being like, "You cannot wave and say hello to everyone," because I was like used to living on an army base and being very friendly. And they were like, we don't want to squash your sunniness, but like,
this is New York.
But this is New York. It's not full of West Germany. So random fact, when I came here, gummy bears were not really big in the United States yet. So I was used to having the delicious treat in Germany. So I remember it was like a special thing to go to a store and get them. But anyway, long story short, I do think I'm biased. I grew up, mostly in New York. And just growing up in New York, it's a certain hustle that's required just to get, something at the bodega, just to back up off the exit when there's traffic. I do think it gives you a mentality of like everything's possible and a real figure it out type of approach.
Sure.
And then coming out of New York, I went to school. I studied psychology actually, because at the time I thought I was considering going either to med school or law school or just taking a bunch of New York government tests, which is what you used to do back in the day, and say, maybe, I don't know, I'll work for some city job. Ended up being recruited to work at the Department of Defense.
Okay.
There had been like this historical alleged scandal that there was a big expose, I think, in the LA Times, that where there was the DOD, Department of Defense, was spending like $500 on hammers and $2,000 on toilets. And it was like, yo, this is taxpayer money. What do we need to do to change it?
Yeah.
So DOD went out and was like, we're going to recruit like bright minds and train them from scratch to just objectively defend the taxpayers. So I'm 21, working at the Department of Defense, was given like a $100 million contract.
Wait. So you're working within the department?
Yes.
To kind of battle the
department? To negotiate. No. To have a new approach to negotiating. What happened was you had people who had been in this field, right, of doing this defense negotiations with contractors like Boeing and so forth for mm-hmm. many years. They honestly kind of knew each other so well for 30 years, probably just weren't the toughest.
Sure.
So we're like, let's bring in just totally fresh people
yeah.
that we trained from scratch. I went to what was called the Defense Acquisition University
okay.
and was actually trained in negotiations. So it was for a first job.
Gotcha.
It's freaking incredible.
So you're trained to negotiate defense contracts.
Yes, for the United States
like
government.
Contractors, when you're like sourcing products or whatever.
So like I worked on trainer jets
okay.
or like cool night vision goggles gotcha. For naval air, stuff like that. And I would procure them for the United States government.
And so basically the contracts before this point were just super bloated.
It was like an attempt to like bring things, get order in yeah, and be yeah. more efficient and protect taxpayer
yeah,
dollars.
Yeah, just like this is
yeah.
egregious.
So
we're
yes,
not paying $2,000 for toilets anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a response to that. Yes.
So you were able to take part of this program.
They, oh my gosh,
they were recruiting,
amazing.
Were they looking for
yeah, so I went to college in the DMV area, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area. So I suspect they were just recruiting locally.
Okay.
I don't think my major was such a it was more just they were just looking for a level of like discipline and who can we really train
okay.
Quickly. And at the time I was leaning more towards law school. So I was like, yeah, I want to learn about negotiating contracts. Great. I'll take this and use it when I go to law school. It was honestly like the most incredible training. I was literally like 50 years younger than almost everybody else I was negotiating with. So like I had to know my shit. I had to like... you know, the language of dealing in Department of Defense is riddled with acronyms and shorthand. So you just had to spend my weekend just studying how to even have a negotiation because a gazillion.
Just to know how to
just
sit
to
at the
know
table.
How to sit at the table, you know, memorizing everything in the federal acquisition regulations, which is just as titillating as it sounds. because everyone was like, why are you in the room? Like, how are you? You're 21. Like, you know what I mean? So it was 21, like very few women and like no minorities for
a
country mile.
Talking to you like you're the secretary.
Totally. Yeah. Like, you know, sweetheart, please. Like, why are you here?
Yeah.
But it was, I wouldn't change one thing.
I was gonna say, would you find them, in my experience, I feel like I've always appreciated being underestimated because like, it's like a win-win-win situation for me. Like, there's no way I can lose here because, like, if I don't absolutely crush it, all I did was match people's expectations of what they had of me.
Absolutely.
And if I do anything above that, then people are like, "Wow,
oh my goodness!" Like, yeah. The only thing I don't like about being underestimated is just waste both of our time because I'm going to provide value in any room I'm in. So like, come join me where we are. Let's get to the baseline as fast as we are because we're wasting time and money until you get to where I'm already at.
That's a fair point. What are some ways that you did that? Do you recall like any sort of like practical kind of?
Honestly, you know, it's corny, but it was really just extra preparation. It was just a lot of hard ass work. Yeah. It was a lot of relationship management. I think maybe my psych degree came in handy where I was always thoughtful and still today think about like all the tools you have in your personal arsenal and in negotiation. Negotiation doesn't have to be like, I'm meeting you at dawn to have a you negotiate all day long. I negotiate with my 10-year-old, my husband about movies in the way you interact in relationships. And when do people need kindness? When do people need grace? Yeah. When do people need a tough point of view? When do people need to be frightened? And understanding what tools need to be sharpened, when you use them, how you use them, how you pulse them.
Yeah.
That was something I think I was able to sharpen underpinned by what I learned in Defense Acquisition University on negotiations.
Well, and there's not a lot of room in areas like that. There's not a lot of room for like fucking up, right? Like the margin of error is very, you know, very slim.
Yeah, for sure.
Because you're negotiating $100 million defense contracts.
By the way, anytime you're an underserved, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, a left-handed person in a right-handed community or you're young black woman when nobody else is young black. There's not a lot of room for error if you're a person that's unusual in your environment also.
Yeah.
Just in general.
Yeah. You just can't, you're not allowed to make the same mistakes.
Definitely not.
Definitely. Yeah, there's going to be less leniency.
Precisely.
Yeah, and probably people actually looking for
100%
mistakes to be made.
Pools. Yeah.
So they can have an excuse.
I knew it was going to happen kind of thing. Yeah, so mm-hmm. you have to be so out in front of that.
Right.
That, you know, I just leaned into ensuring I was operating at the highest levels of excellence.
When you sit down at the table with somebody like that in like kind of an intimidating setting for any young person to be in with that doesn't have the experience, when they're like, it's always intimidating for somebody that's in their 20s to sit down with somebody who's in their 50s who's been doing this for 30 years or whatever. But then you add in the dynamic of being a young Black woman in that scenario.
Yeah.
Was there any like psychological tricks or hacks or anything that you did like within the first 3 minutes of sitting down to get that person to be like, sorry, I did not realize that you were this sophisticated or that we were actually going to move into this part of the conversation or whatever.
Yeah, I think a lot is preparation.
Okay.
So I made it clear. I also don't, I'm like probably obsessed about time. So I don't, my thing is I'm not going to wait 15 minutes to convince you why I'm here. In the first two or three minutes, I want to make sure I convey my knowledge base, the preparation, my understanding, but also my respect. I'm very respectful of like humanity in general.
Yeah.
So I'm not coming off as if like, I know I have a lot to learn, right? Mm-hmm. What I do know, I want to share with you that I'm respectful enough of your time to take the time to appropriately prepare.
Yeah.
I think that can soften a lot of hard edges out the gate. And it's, you know, still works.
Yeah. To me, preparation is the antidote to inexperience.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, if you don't have a ton of experience, you better make up for it with over-preparation. You can find it.
My mother literally as a child used to say, like, what does not knowing have to do with finding out? So like there was no, they asked me a question. They'd be like, we spent all this money on Encyclopedia Britannica. If you guys don't know what that is, it's like Googling books. Mm-hmm. And and they'd be like, no, we can find the answer out. Call on such and such. Ask your neighbor. Ask somebody. So I was always raised to like, no, answers and information exist. You just have to be, intense about the pursuit of obtaining it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So how long are you with the department?
Just a few years. And then I got bored, honestly. Okay. So I started promoting parties. Just got some of my friends and we would throw these big parties.
So law school was out the window though?
Law school at this point was out the window. I was like, I'm not doing it. I talked to a bunch of lawyers who actually were like, I literally called like 20 lawyers. People connected me and they were all like, don't go. Like, it's horrible. worst years of my life. Not an endorsing thing. Right? Yeah. I was like, all right.
To me, it seems like being a lawyer is like, you really got to geek out about the law.
You really got to. Oh, by the way, it's still useful. It's the kind of thing that's useful to be if you don't practice.
Sure.
But it was such an unresounding, so expensive. So I ended up I was living in like a remote town, the southernmost tip of Maryland. And that was also tough. Like as a New York girl, the town was in an uproar, like around getting stoplights and waiting for
That's where I was working.
Okay. Yeah. So I moved closer to a city closer to DC. Got into sales, radio sales, actually, which was my first entree.
Radio sales. What do you mean?
Radio sales. So basically, I was selling like commercials, concert sponsorships, you know, just ad time.
So ad sales for radio stations.
Yeah, you hear like them like, the weather is brought to you by such and such. Right. So I would be the person that was selling that.
Did it feel like moving down a weight class, going from negotiating Department of Defense contracts to like, convincing an advertiser to spend money on the radio?
It didn't, but it just felt really hard. It didn't feel because it is I often say, like, at least that time selling radio was like selling crack, because you're like, you know what I'm saying? It was like but you had none of the addiction. Like, you're like on these streets. You know what I mean? Like, so it's hard. And you were I was only paid, it was like kind of kill what you eat. I was paid a certain amount, but I had to sell enough to cover it.
Sure.
You get a draw. Exactly. People, right? So that was hard, but it taught me that, like, it was really the first thing that proved to me that I could run my own business because I was able to, I got my customers, I was able to break new customers and start to really eat what you kill. And that, you get hungry enough, you'd be surprised how capable you become.
That's right.
Right.
That's
so, right. So that was super important. And it was another great experience. I got another chance at incredible training. I was working Clear Channels. I got to be trained in out of home advertisement. How does radio work? How do you buy a television advertisement?
Wow.
How brands are built. And I'm the type that, like, you know, back when I was an employee, everything that came up, you might want to take, I'm taking that class, sign me up, just to learn as much as I could.
Where did you, was that innate in you? The desire to learn?
It always comes back to your family, I think, right? Like, I definitely grew up in, both my parents read a lot. My dad taught me chess. My mother would play Scrabble with me. I definitely grew up in a family that rewarded curiosity.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. I ask those questions now from a selfish standpoint because you saw my kids.
I did, adorable.
A yes. 4-year-old and a 3-year-old. And like now I'm constantly thinking about those things. Like how do I get them to just like get these like core things? Because like they don't have to know everything by the time they leave my house. But like if you know these couple of things, you'll be able to figure out everything else.
Absolutely.
You know? And that's kind of, that's definitely one of those things. Like my son actually the other day said something about, he's going to kindergarten. So we've been kind of just like talking to him about kindergarten and everything. And he said something like, yeah, but in kindergarten, we don't get to play as much or something, or like we have to learn more and like learning, or like he said something about it being boring or like not as fun as playing or whatever. And I was like, well, buddy, that just depends on the type of learning that you do. And like learning can actually be really fun. And I was like talking to him about this book that I'm reading right now. I was just like, that's definitely one of those things that I feel like the school system is set up completely to like underserve the people that go to it, because they do teach you that learning sucks. It's like you go to recess to play and then you sit in a classroom and get taught this one learning style that's not effective for every kid in the classroom.
Yeah, it's super outdated. And it's also the worst part is that there's this idea that learning sits in some four walls.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's something, and it's actually not. It's woven into the fabric. You eat a delicious taco, you just learn something for the first time. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that's
learning's
happening
all day long. Like, you get an Uber and you're right. I love that. You can, yeah, exactly. Like, I just was trying to do the best college I ever had. Incredible. Like, but you're sensory learning, you're experienced learning, you're learning from life. Like, you're learning all day long. And this idea, you go to a place and sit down in this rigorous style is not a fair I think it's actually like bad branding.
It's
for
detrimental
learning.
Because you know, you ask anybody who's been out of high school or college for like a decade plus to tell you like the last book they read or the last thing, you know, it's just like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like nobody told me to read. It's like it gives you this idea that learning is done when you're done with school.
Right.
It's
no,
like, that's
exactly
not how it works.
But like I watched the movie Blackberry on the way here. I was probably Blackberry's number one fan when it used to be out. And I was like, I actually learned a lot watching it. Like it doesn't, this idea that it's isolated.
Yeah.
It has a born on date is preposterous.
Yeah. But that's awesome. Your parents like instilled that in you.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Obviously took, you know,
yeah.
For you to continue, like, people ask me sometimes about, you know, what my advice to 18-year-olds is. And, you know, if you're a young person coming out of high school or college, what would I say to go do or whatever? And I did 6 years of door-to-door 100% commission sales, which is very similar to kind of what you're talking about. But you had even more like of a rigorous schedule out of that by be able to like learn negotiating 9-figure contracts when you're that young. And then to be able to go into radio and do sales and get that hunger to like go again, eat what you kill. Like you're not going to get paid unless you go do something, like to be able to do that. And then like those environments force you to learn so much because you're not going to make it if you don't. Like you don't have any other option. It's quit or learn. There's not anything else you can do about it. But then also for you to be sales in a marketing environment to learn about marketing. So now like by the time you're out of your 20s, you got negotiating massive contracts, not negotiating little thing, negotiating massive contracts. You got sales experience and you understand how marketing and advertising works with these massive brands at a macro level, working with Clear Channel, getting that type of training. Like, man, what a incredible resume stack and skill stack to come out of your 20s with.
It was. And the thing is, you don't, you know, this is the thing too, you don't necessarily know at the time what's going to be useful, right? When I was negotiating at Department of Defense, I didn't know I could take those same skills and fast forward to, you know, negotiating for Sean Diddy Combs or DJ Khaled, like in celebrity, like those same skills. Or when I was in radio, I didn't know how helpful it would be later on working with artists and understanding how it works or how to build a brand from behind it.
Yeah.
Like, but a lot of times, you know, we take for granted the moment we're in instead of real, like we're building this tapestry, right? To be a launch pad for the future of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. And to that many powerful, like, skills, like the pure stack that you built during that time is allowed you to be able to go do whatever you wanted to do at that point, and without even probably realizing that was what was happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you don't realize it until you start speaking the language of those things. Like you speak the language of negotiation or sales or marketing, and then people who like aren't as good or maybe they're newer will be like, wait, what did you just say? It's almost like you're speaking a foreign language to them and you're like, I didn't even realize that I was doing that.
Not at all.
You know what I mean?
Not
but it's
all.
Just so
especially
second nature now.
It's the weirdest thing. Like I have a 10-year-old and negotiations really needs to be taught at kindergarten.
Yeah.
Right. It's really a matter of how the art of persuasion. The problem this country has right now is we're so divided because we don't know how to like articulate in the right way to negotiate, to persuade one another, to respect other opinions.
Yeah.
Like I remember learning debate and learning the difference between attacking somebody with logic, attacking somebody in person, like in fifth grade. I don't think that kind of thing is taught anymore. And
it's
a gap. Yeah. There we go. It's a proof point. So that's a problem. Like, of course, people are angry and frustrated if they can't get their point out. They don't know how to, you know, reasonably express, persuade, negotiate with one another.
Yeah, right. It can be very frustrating.
Absolutely.
Especially if you don't even realize that some of those things are being used on you either.
Oh, well.
You know, because then it makes it...
Feels like voodoo.
Exactly. Well, then that's when you get the insanely divided far camps that are like shouting at each other from afar, where it's like, have you ever sat down with somebody who believes anything different than you? Like, have you ever had a conversation?
Right.
Have you ever tried to learn anything about what they're talking about?
Yeah.
But like, they don't even realize that these tactics are being used because the people who run the country are smart people. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
The people, like... You don't get to those positions without being a level of competent and having some intelligence about you. You know what I mean? So
like
they know what they're doing. They know the things that they're implementing to get people to be this way. It's just like, if you can have at least some training in those areas, you would at least be able to recognize what's happening and parse through things, think critically about things and come up with your own damn decisions.
Yes. Yeah. Just a critical thinking is like we need a whole nother podcast. Yeah,
right. A whole show dedicated to that.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay. So of those jobs that you held.
Yes.
In your early 20s, mid 20s, late 20s, what was your favorite part of doing those things?
I would say, I think I really love when I was promoting events. I often encourage people to, like, even when you're young, you're trying to learn how to run a business. Event production is like a mini running your business, right? So I had to learn to really understand the math of how many humans came in the door, how many people were comp, how many people were paid. Did it go up from hour to hour? How much were they getting per drink, right? How many comps did I need to have? What was everybody's name? I understand how to brand it, how to be a hostess, how to have relationships with the spirits, how to make sure all my vendors were paid when they walked in, my DJs, cocktail waitresses, how to, like, you know, I wasn't employing them directly, but it taught management skills and interaction.
So this was kind of on the side?
I had a company with some of my friends.
Okay.
And we started just... working with this like DC legend. He's still around now through, is known for caring so deeply about hospitality. So he throws like these pristine events, produces incredible like environments. And I learned a lot under, his name is Mark Barnes, under him in terms of just a discipline in the way you what hospitality really means.
Hmm.
And again, like hospitality, we think about it as some
like the difference segregated between a party space. And an experience.
Precisely. And it was this idea of like hospitality is the way you live your life. So today you come to my house, I want to treat you in that same way of like, oh, I remember they're allergic to this. They love this. I want to introduce them to this new cocktail. I want to show the most beautiful, coolest place. Like just the way you live, you know, for yourself too. But that learning I got from there was, I think, better than any formal training in some ways.
Man, another mixture, another thing to throw in the crock pot of skills there. Honestly, it's like
delicious. Exactly.
Like to me anyway, and I'm no economist or anything, but you know, I have theories. I can think sometimes. You know what I mean?
Philosopher at least.
I feel like soft skills are going to be the thing that runs the world in the next decade, two decades, because the more automation comes out, the more AI takes more jobs, the more these types of things are taking away like technical skills and things like that. It's just gonna be more and more invaluable to be able to network, to know how to talk to people, to be engaging, to build real, genuine relationships with people, to know how to communicate, to persuade, to influence.
It's everything.
Like,
it's actually everything. I've been fortunate, like I've been in all these jobs where they like do your personality tests and all that kind of stuff in different companies. And like, I'm pretty smart. Like I'm an A student smart, but I'm not like physicist smart or but what I always come off the charts on, extraordinary high levels of empathy, extraordinary high emotional intelligence. And in many ways, that's been the most useful tool versus knowing a lot about any particular, you know, genre or subject.
Yeah. Especially in terms of your career, you know,
like your life.
It will always lead to greater impact a lot of times bigger salaries.
Yeah.
You know, the salespeople are always the best paid. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, absolutely, that's just how marketers are always the best paid. If you know how to communicate, if you know how to persuade, leaders are always the best paid. You know, C-suite for a reason. They're not just the C-suite because they have like technical skills exclusively. Right. It's because they know how to lead divisions of people.
Oh, and absolutely.
They know how to take a bunch of people with different views and backgrounds and contexts and cultures and put them together for one common mission and be able to like to do that successfully is not an easy
task. It's not anything. You're a general. You may not be the best sniper, right?
Sure.
You know what I mean? But you have to have a certain level of intelligence in the way you communicate to galvanize, yep, right? Excitement to lead people forward.
Mm-hmm. The humility required to do precisely. That effectively, you know, to build a culture of people that actually are wanting to see your vision come to pass.
Yeah.
You know, like those things are so, they're so crucial. And I think they're just going to continue to get more and more important.
Totally
the more
agree.
The hard skills are just going to be replaced by technology.
It's happening.
Okay. Events, this was a business that you were running.
Kind of doing same time in DC. Yeah, same
at the same
area.
Time.
Yeah,
of
yes.
The,
I was doing radio sales and then I was also doing pharmaceutical sales. And during that time, I was,
Okay. So you were just tasting a lot of stuff,
trying a bunch of different stuff.
Yep. What was your philosophy on like money and finances during that time? Like, were you kind of miserly? Were you more like.
No, I was not miserly. What I didn't know, like in my 20s, I didn't know much about capital markets, right? So we were making like pretty good money for that time, for our age. And you know, we would save and there were some smart decisions we made, but I wish I understood much more about investment. Mm. At that point, I didn't really start learning about that until my 30s.
Another massive gap in our education system.
Totally.
It frustrates me so much. Just like, if you're not an entrepreneur or business person, you just don't learn about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the only reason I know about that stuff is because I actively pursued a career in that world after high school, college time. It's maddeningly frustrating to look at the sheer lack of education around even how your credit card works and how,
totally,
you know, interest payments work and how compound interest can, you know, multiply your net worth. Like there's so many people who are just like,
don't know at all. And it's getting worse, not better.
Right. I mean, I read a stat the other day. It was like close to 80% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. That blew my mind. It was like, yes, there might be some like issues there in terms of like increased wages or whatever, but
sure,
a lot of times it's just sheer complete misunderstanding of how to manage your finances.
Relationship of money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even just the talk, like, you know, it's the exchange of like services for money is no different than silver for fish or,
yep,
you know,
yep,
what I mean? Or basically, but people still have a very weird relationship with money that is some like thing you have to be worried and get ready to talk about instead of like, no, it's natural. It's like talk about like breathing.
I'm glad you said relationship with money, because that's usually how I frame it when we talk about it, because it is, it sounds kind of weird and conceptual, but if you're doing it correctly, you have to have a relationship with money. Like money is an energy source. You know what I mean? And
source.
It will treat you the same way you treat it. You know what I mean? So
absolutely.
If you just decide to never learn about it, if you neglect it and ignore it all the time, then it's probably going to ignore you.
Yeah.
It's probably
going to be hard to find.
Your bank account's going to be reflecting of that. Yeah. Yes. But yeah, that's another one of those things. Just like, I just have no idea why we're not learning this.
It makes,
you know,
zero
at
sense.
A younger age.
I mean, both ways.
Yeah.
Double entendre.
Yeah. Those are the times that like make me engage in conspiracy theories sometimes.
Right.
It's like, how, like, you guys see the data, right? You're seeing the same data I'm seeing. Like, there's no financial literacy across the country.
No,
but
not
like,
at all.
They're like, nobody's trying to do anything about that except for privatized companies like that are doing education and some of them in nefarious ways. And then, you know, even wealth managers that are making a shit ton of money off of people's retirement accounts and then slashing their compound interest with their high management fees. Just like, there's so much stuff that we just were never taught. You would have never any clue if you just like lived life and tried to do
what everybody else
tells
easily,
you to do.
It's easy not to know. And it's, you know, as long as we continue to overly embrace like ruthless individualism, then but it's actually silly, because the more people who know, then it's better for the country. It's actually better for all of us.
Yes.
Right. To drive more wealth.
Tide,
it's not it's not an either or proposition. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that does not really exist in a meaningful way in people's hearts and minds to me in America.
Mm-hmm.
That like, no, we can all get it. Like the world's abundant. Like it's not really.
Yep.
It's not really entrenched.
More for you does not mean less for me.
Precisely.
Right. Okay, so you said you're in your 30s when you start learning a little bit more about capital markets and things like that. So what's the transition to finally, because I read it, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't know if, how accurate the source was. You started working for Diddy's company as an assistant, executive assistant?
Executive assistant, that's exactly right.
Was that to Diddy or was that to somebody?
Directly
so
was, to, okay.
So talk to me about how that whole relationship came about.
Yeah, so I got back into radio again in New York. And there was a new station that was launching called Power 105 against a legacy hip hop station called Hot 97. Hot 97, if in, in hip hop, was really one of the original stations that helped become hip hop, become a beacon to the world, right? Okay. So Puff was very loyal to that station. And when I was working at Power 105, his record label at the time refused to advertise it out of loyalty to Hot 97.
Okay.
I inherited all the music labels as clients at Power 105. So I had the other, I had all the other labels, but I was trying to convince Bad Boy Records to advertise with us. And I finally got them to, because our station was a little more female friendly. And Bad Boy Records had signed a new act called New Edition. And they were more geared towards female. And I was like, guys, y'all, you're just being ridiculous. You're going to not spend your money on it. You're going to be able to move these units. Like now you're just actually punching your own self in the face. So I finally broke them. And the station was delighted. And then I was able to get more and more business from them. And at one point, one of his executives called me and said, you know, Puff is looking to hire a new chief of staff. I feel like you send emails at 3 a.m. and so does he. Like, I feel like y'all will get along, so would you come in for an interview? I'm like, yeah, sure. And I definitely have always been like, yeah, I'll take the interview, because you just never know what opportunities. I'm a big like say yes, right, and figure it out. So go, interviews wild short, it's like 6 minutes, great questions, but like really
was it with his team or was it with
Puff? It was with him directly. I had an interview with his HR person, then an interview
with
him.
Was that the first time you'd met him?
It was the first time I met him like that. I grew up in New York, so I was like, had been to Puff parties and been around, but no, I didn't hadn't met him directly until that moment. And then they called me and said, he would like to offer you the job, but you've not managed large teams before. So instead of chief of staff, would you be willing to come on as executive assistant? It was literally like, you could call me the janitor, but this is what, I don't care about titles. I was like, but this is what
really
I need to make.
Really
I was really wanted to learn.
Yeah.
And I was just like, look, at the end of the day, I was still in radio sales again. So I was eat what you kill. I was like, salary does sound kind of sexy.
I was like, kind of cool to know that I'm going to get paid every Friday.
I love that. But more importantly, I was like, this guy represents such a level of, you know, optimizing opportunities, like such a beautiful manifestation of the American dream. I just felt like it's something I could really learn a lot from. And I did. I was ended up being there for 14 years. And I'm also a big believer in like, if I was there for 3 weeks, I still would have been fine about whatever I learned and whatever I contributed. And then there's, you know, there's lots of other opportunities I could have gone on to do.
Yeah. So would you have put him in a category of like hero at that time for you? Or was that like just the on paper, it was just so good?
Yeah. No, hero is a strong word. I take that like a serious word. Like it's like probably just my parents. I would even describe like that. Right. Okay. But I definitely had a huge admiration for his business prowess. And I knew he knew a lot of things that I didn't know. Really that simply. I was like, I could probably learn a lot over here.
Yeah.
And I am. I'm a curious person. I'm absolutely a geek. I love learning as much as possible. And I was like, this is a modern day apprenticeship opportunity. So I want to go in and, you know, make a go. And,
commending you for this, too. I think people have a natural aversion to anything that would be perceived to be a step backwards.
Yes.
And it's like, there's several points in just the time that we've been talking where like, you were just like, oh, fuck that. Like if it makes sense, it makes sense. And if I want to do it, I want to do it. Like where most people would be like, you went from selling defense contracts to like hawking radio sales.
Right.
Like, why would you do that? Like you went from, you know, making this money to being an assistant. Why would you do that?
Same.
You know, it's just like,
yeah, still making money. No.
Because everybody's prioritizing the wrong shit is the thing.
Totally.
You know, they're prioritizing what the culture says they should do, or what their parents said they should do, or what their professor told them that was the right thing to do, or whatever, rather than just like treating life like the playground that it is.
Oh my God. Yes. Kind of also, don't be a penny wise. Like, I was fortunate that I was always advancing financially, I was always negotiating the cash.
Yeah.
But to your point, I was more around what are the experiences going to be like and what can I learn? And moreover, at this point, I'm 30. I knew I wasn't going to be doing radio sales. I was like, let me get into a position.
You were 30 at the time?
When I started, I had turned, within my first week, I had turned 30 week before that, right?
Okay.
So I was like, look, I want to figure out what I really want to do long term, not a series of jobs, but like, what am I going to do that can get an imprint on the world? So I would have actually been willing to do something where I could apprentice to open up my eyes to so many things. At that time, when I went to work for Puff, I got to be involved with 5 television shows in production at once, managing 22 licensees at Sean John, launching a fragrance from scratch, one of the biggest companies in the world, building a spirits brand, like relaunching it. So I got to see so many different, sit at a purview, right, to be able to see so many different businesses. And I would have never got that type of learning at a major organization.
Well, and to be able to get the literal behind the scenes glance at how somebody like that operates on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely.
You're obviously, like, as an executive assistant, I can only assume you're managing his schedule, his personal communications, and talking to him constantly, every day. Like, you're like the extension of him, like his actual arm. You know what I mean? And as an executive assistant, that's your job. And the best ones, like, people don't understand, executive assistants get paid 6 figures.
Oh, yeah.
Like, multiple 6 figures.
Absolutely, yeah.
To do what
they do. Especially in New York,
It's a gig and a half.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because
you're really,
if you're really doing it right for something like that, you're committed.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I would tell my friends, I'm my friends and family, I was like, pretend I'm, like, I went to war.
You're
like, I'm going for 6 months.
Brain,
like, you are all in.
You become an extension of that person.
Totally.
For sure.
Yeah.
How long were you in the executive assistant role before you start kind of like seeing some?
Yeah, not long. So I was executive assistant, and then within 3 months, he promoted me to senior executive assistant. That's a promotion. And then I would say another 3 months, I'd been there for a full 6 months, and I felt that I was doing what was described in the original chief of staff role. So I went to him and proactively said, look, I feel like I'm taking on things that I'm reading it. I feel like I'm doing these things, or anything you see as a gap. If not, you know, let's keep moving forward. I'll stop there for a second, because I'm a big believer in, like, have a quarterly business review with yourself in the mirror. Like, people's like, a lot of times just let, you know, life happen to them. You go to work every, you have to actually be really intentional about how you're holding yourself accountable. Are you moving forward in the way you want to be moving in whatever direction that is and whatever's important to you? And that could be a strawberry farm. That could be your personal fitness. But for me, I was like, I'm not going to just accidentally be here for 20 years.
So let's talk about this for a second.
Yeah.
Zoom in from a practical perspective. If somebody's listening to this and they're like, I've been thinking about trying to negotiate a raise at my job, or, and I just don't know how to ask, or I'm timid about it. I'm not that great at that. How do you come across that? What do you say? How do you ask them? What's the appropriate way to ask? In you know, assuming that this person is actually good at what they do, adding value to the company, you know, what's the best way to approach that?
I mean, I think it's feedback based. Go to payscale.com. Go to SHRM, SHRM. Right. Go to Glassdoor. Look at what you should be being paid for what you're doing. Look at where you're impacting the bottom line to either make money or save resources, right, or contribute resources in a meaningful way. If you're not a person that's comfortable having that conversation, slowly take the time to write it down. Ask your homie who is good with it and articulate it in writing. But also, I think you got to always be prepared. I'm a person like, be prepared to leave.
Yeah.
It's cool. Like, any relationship that's not serving you at this time, there actually are, like, it may not feel like it, but there are gazillions of jobs.
Again, talking about abundance.
Gazillion of things you can do to sell right now. The internet has democratized anything. You could sell beautiful golden straws at home and kiss your baby at 2 a.m. You know what I mean? Like, there's all, it's a different way. So I think being comfortable and always keeping yourself, like, I hate to say it, but like, market ready in any way.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, at any day, I mean, don't get me wrong. I believe in the sanctity of, like, marriage, for example, but nonetheless, you still, even within a committed relationship, you want to be your best self.
For sure.
Right, objectively.
Yeah.
And then how dope is it that together you're better? And that's at work and that's at home. And then if you come with that mentality, like, my thing is, like, anywhere I am, I try to be like, if I leave right now, I feel really good about what I contributed. So, like, you don't owe that job anything. And as long as the job has paid you out, they shouldn't owe anything. But don't feel beholden. But also stand for what you're worth.
Yeah.
Because you're only going to work to make money.
Right.
Like, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's the primary reason, right? I mean, hopefully people love their jobs, or primarily you're there to make money. So, yeah, you got to be proactive about going to ask, particularly, you know, everybody knows you make more money when you go from place to place. So if you're at the same place, they have to value that, because actually retention is really expensive. I mean, I'm sorry, not like you leaving and them having to re-recruit.
Acquisition is expensive. Yeah,
recruitment's really expensive. Yeah. So you leaving is just going to cost them more money. And don't hesitate to bring that up. I want to stay. I have no desire to leave. This is what I'm looking for. It will cost you X amount to replace me. And let's just, you know, stay together.
Right.
Stay together.
Yeah. You just got to be willing to have the uncomfortable conversations.
Absolutely.
You know, everything, somebody said that one time, and I, like, always held on to it. I wish I'd give him credit, but everything you want in life is on the other side of an uncomfortable conversation.
Absolutely.
And most people just aren't willing to have the uncomfortable conversation.
Got
to
do it.
And like you said, you also have to be comfortable with leaving. And I think that's probably the thing that holds people back more is the fear that that petition will be rejected and that it might shine a light on the fact that maybe we don't even need this person to begin with. And then you lose your job.
Good,
or whatever.
But then you don't want to be suppression of value
exactly.
anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So you got to think about the career in terms of years rather than like what's going to happen in the next 3 months.
Exactly. You know exactly. But you got to stay ready is the piece.
Yeah. And don't underestimate the power of a small raise either. You know, like people think about that too, or they're like, well, but it's only, 12% or whatever, 8%. And it's like
12% is a lot year over year. It's way more. Average is 2-5%.
You compound that over a long period of time. It's like, you can't afford to not do this, you know?
Yeah.
Well, especially now with crazy.
By the way,
inflation,
your time is so valuable.
Right.
Right. It's the most thing. It's actually your priceless.
Most valuable
so
resource.
Yeah. So you actually have to protect yourself. You're, it's this idea of you don't want to have one uncomfortable conversation, but all you do is signing yourself up for 10 years of uncomfortable living because you're probably being underpaid. You know what I mean? It's a choice.
Yeah. Choose the hard thing that you want. You know, both paths are going to be hard. Just one of them is more like ripping the Band-Aid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. So back into the story here. You get promoted to senior executive assistant.
Yeah.
And then
promote chief of staff. And then, we had a comedy tour called Bad Boys of Comedy. We're working with an organization called Diageo, who's the biggest beverage alcohol supplier in the world.
So your company would produce the Bad Boys of Comedy tour?
We work with HBO, and then we produce the tour and help find the comedians and so forth, right?
I didn't know that.
So a brand called Crown Royal was a sponsor of it, and we started having conversations about maybe getting into spirits. Now, Puff was well known at this time for throwing like elaborate parties. So he was known as like master of hospitality. And he had gotten a lot of spirits offers before, but he had been reticent to do it. He wanted to make sure he felt a certain responsibility to the community, so forth. Anyway, when we decided to have the conversations, I was his chief of staff. And I said, listen, I would like to be part of the team. I don't know if you remember, I'm trained in negotiations. I want to be part of the negotiation team with Diageo for us to move forward with this brand called Ciroc Vodka. So he said, yeah, sure, it's fine. So tap me in. It was a very small group of us. We negotiated. We got an incredible, never heard before deal in the space. And once we were about to launch, I went back and said, I would like to be lead on rebuilding the previous ad agency he had called Blue Flame and being the point person for this team. I want to turn this business around. I want to be the point person to manage Ciroc Vodka. He said, you need to replace yourself as chief of staff. And you can do it. So I went, I designed
the major props
agency
to him too for
100%
being on board 100% of the 100%. Way, like giving you
the freedom continue to grow. Yes. Yeah. I mean, he was always, the one thing I loved about that environment is, and I would used to tell anybody when I would hire them, I'm like, if you're like, I got a dope plan to sell buttons and you can articulate the economics, the cultural impact, what are we going to do good for populations? Like, when bring it down, he's gonna be like, okay, let's go. Let's get it done. Now I went and actually got the funding to run the team and do everything else and was self-sufficient. He was like, go do it. Finally, I ended up, we kept going. We couldn't get another chief of staff to last. So like a year later, I was doing both. So it was legit. Like, oh, we're promoters and what's going on with supply?
Week.
Where's the glass? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's a twins' birthday party to Jess Lay. So it was like a little, and I was like, yo, we have a chance. And I was actually wrong at the time because it's as public. It was just recently in the news that, he ended up making, close to $1 billion, 908 something during that time. But I was like, this is clearly at least $100 million opportunity. I can see we're already up 1,000% in like 100 zip codes. So with all respect to how important your personal life is, I cannot effectively continue to book jets and manage children and manage all your homes as well as build this business. And I think I'm going to have to go, even if you don't have a chief of staff, we need to make a decision. Also, and this goes back to what we were talking about. I was like, for myself, I'm not doing anything half-assed. And right now I cannot feel like I'm proud of myself because I feel like we're doing good. It's working. And he's like, what are you talking about? It's great.
Yeah.
I was like, no, it's not. And I actually, to the point we just said, I actually quit.
Okay.
And I'm not a fake quitter. Like, I really I take it very seriously. I sent a lovely letter. I'm organizing all the information. I'm going to help recruit. I want to honor the time I was there. But I was like, I'm not going to stay and do it. And
how long had you been there at that time?
At that time, I had been there 4 years.
Okay. Got it.
4 years. And I was like, I'm going to take the next 30 days to slowly get everything going. I'm always going to be here, blah, blah, blah. And then I want to say like 3 weeks in, the current CFO walked in and said, Puff said, give you whatever you want. So I was like, all right. Like smart man, smart man. And then from there, we built a case. We ended up building like a legitimate Case History and Spirits, where we grew that brand to be multi-billion dollar retail value brand, sold all around the world. And so many other brands that followed it were because of the success of Ciroc Vodka.
Before we kind of move into your success in the spirit space, I just want to point something out before we move on. If you didn't do all of the work of stacking those skills for that entire time that you, I mean, because now we're talking about from age 21 to age 34-ish, if my math is right, like that you were just constantly working, learning, getting feedback from people, getting mentored, like exponential learning and increase of your skill. If you did not do that, then you wouldn't have like gotten them to give you whatever you wanted. Like I just don't want to have somebody listen to this going like, I do need to just go ask for what I want.
Right. No.
And it's like, well, but like sometimes you don't deserve it though. Like sometimes you like,
by the way, there's intrinsic value in certain things.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
I'm not going to pay $100 for a tangerine.
Say.
Like end of
That's
the day, like
yep.
there's a, so there's two important things. One is like you have to create objective, not like actual value, right?
Yeah.
For you provide. That's commensurate with what you're asking for. One. And that's a piece that people really, you're right, you sometimes miss it and just like, I never come from a, I deserve it.
Yeah, they're like, well, I deserve
it. I come from like the data,
yeah.
Any independent person, put me in a, just put the stats up.
Yeah.
Like put me on a field, you don't even need to know who I am, and your stats have to make sense objectively against what you're trying, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the point differentiation.
Yes, you get paid for the value you bring to the organization.
Yeah.
Yeah. The point is to try to make your time more valuable than other people's time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then when they're faced with the idea of like, oh, we're either going to lose her or we got to give her whatever she wants. We got to just give her whatever she wants because she's that valuable. And like people that are good leaders know that valuable people will never stay in a situation that's going to compress their opportunity. It's just like you have to give good people the opportunity.
1,000%, because good people already have opportunities.
Correct.
So that's the thing you got to always realize. Like anybody around me, like I have had people work with me for 20 years at this point. Because I'm like, if I see somebody great, I want you to have a wonderful life. I want to support everything you have, your whole person, right? Because I recognize that if you're great at whatever you're doing, I'm not the only person who's going to notice that.
Yes.
So I'm grateful if you're choosing to be with me, and we have to have a requited and healthy respect and relationship.
Yeah. It's like one of the best compliments I get is when people compliment my team. You know what I mean? It's like, oh man, this person just took care of me. It was so good. Like it was such a pleasure to work with them. You know,
the
just
best.
Like, I always screenshot it, send it to them, just like say thanks. You know what I mean? With a little bonus or whatever. It's just like, man, you keep crushing it. You know,
totally.
Like, that's what you want. It's just like you got good people are hard to come by, and that's kind of my whole broader point to bring this little sidetrack up is just to say that like, if you're gonna go in, you know, guns blazing like that, better have the receipts.
Totally.
You know, to be able to force the hand.
Totally.
And force it in a happy way, right? Like,
yeah, and that's the thing. I'm not a big, like, I don't have to.
You're not
really
threatening.
I'm not, it's no threat. It's no threat. It's all good. It's all good because, like, this is the beauty of, like, when you are clear on what each of your values are, and each of us have our own unique values, right? To bring to the table. It's not something special about it that you and I are talking about. But if for some reason it hadn't worked out, I feel very good that. He was before he knew me. He would have went on to be successful, and I feel really good that I would have went on to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes you have a great group together, right? Like the magic
synergy
of a certain team, right? And that's like you do want to break that team up or that musical act up, like, oh, they're not quite the same, right? So that's something you have to recognize and respect. But it's the kind of thing of where like you make these choices, and then you make that choice the right choice. It's like when you go out, nobody's going to be like, I can't believe you didn't wear the yellow dress in your closet. They don't know what I was going to wear. What am I dressing up? Right. So you make the choice and like you just now you have to just keep going forward in that choice and do what it takes to make it right.
Right. Okay. So Ciroc, massive success.
Yes.
Talk to me about the building stages behind that.
Oh
was
my gosh.
Was there a lot behind the scenes that you guys did to make it this brilliant case study?
Huge. I mean, it was like one of the things when none of us had worked in the spirits industry.
Yeah.
So we brought all of the like hustle and intensity of the music industry, fashion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then laser focused in how we built this brand.
What year was this?
This was 2007.
Okay. So this was kind of like, there weren't a ton of celebrity spirits brands back then.
No. They were literally there had been like Billy Dee Williams in like the 80s. There was no, this was not a thing.
Yeah.
In fact, the deal was kind of laughed at by the industry at the time.
By that spirits industry.
By the spirits industry. Yeah. They were like, oh, that's
just didn't
gets
realize
too
the
much
power
money.
Of the personal brand.
Didn't realize. Yeah, right. So what we understood, and I used to always say, his celebrity was actually the least of what he brought to the table, right?
Hmm.
We had a real paradigm that understood how to elegantly have culture meet commerce in a respectful way, right? And be respectful to things like, okay, we're in music, so we know that every week there's 300 DJs that get on a call. How are we going to make sure that they understand the power of this brand, that they benefit from success, and that we respect them, and we're not just treating it like a one-time promotion, you know, once a year, right? And at that time, it was a French vodka, right? It was for everyone. Mm-hmm. But minority communities were really only getting that type of branding and support, like for, oh, it's Chinese New Year, or it's Black History Month. Mm-hmm. Not sustained, glamorous, meaningful investment at a steady drum that was culturally relevant. The thing about at that time, our team, and you kind of can't fake this, at that time, our team really knew, like, oh, have y'all heard about this new act named Lady Gaga? Like, we knew how to be at the right moments at the right time to insert this brand at this juxtaposition of culture creation moments. And we made it a system. It was like a whole social diffusion model of like what's happening this week so that this brand can move at the speed of culture. 1 year, Ciroc was in 50 songs because we had a studio program. Like, these are the things nobody would even know about, but having relationships with every studio booker around the country, right? Deep relationships with them, respecting what they do, finding out who's coming in the studio, bringing in delicious food, drinks, mixing it up for them. Yeah. Like, that kind of thing got us in 50 songs. Like, that it was organic, but it took a lot of work behind the scenes to set up and make these organic moments go.
And the product had to be good.
And the product, bar none, has to be good, or we wouldn't do it.
Yeah, because you can put that stuff in front of people all day long, but if it sucks,
I mean, for one, we wouldn't do it. But two, it's like customers are too smart. I think it's disrespectful.
Yes,
like you can create. The joke used to be like, I could make anybody's birthday a national holiday. But like, if you come the first time and it's whack, and I don't know, and the temperature is off, and the liquid's at the right temperature, and the music mix is confusing. Right. Like, you're not coming back the next year. We're inviting people to be in a long term relationship where we respect where they bring to the table, and we really come full force.
Yeah. How do you go through the initial stages of product testing with something like alcohol?
Yeah. So obviously, we were always concerned and really vigilant about responsibility, right? And really making sure we were encouraging compliance and so forth. What was interesting about Ciroc, and this is one of the fun parts of it, was as we started to explore flavors, and this could be debated one way or the other, I would spend a lot of time, part of my job would be going around, like, to, living in New York, I might go to the six blocks that had like a high density Polish population and get unusual flavors to bring in so that we could be tasting all kind of flavor profiles to think through what are the next flavors that we want to come out with.
Gotcha.
And I got to learn a lot about innovation and R&D, and a lot of Puff's personalities, he thrives in a lab setting, right? So whether it was fragrance labs, and we have 300 different components of what makes a fragrance, or whether it was music labs, or whether it was innovation labs to make Ciroc Peach, which came out and you know, moved more cases than anybody could ever expect it. That process was really interesting and intriguing.
Yeah. So you come out with the product. How quickly did you realize that you had something that was unique and was going to make a splash that you were really not expecting?
We knew within 90 days. I mean, because we launched, and so again, because we were so hardworking and so just everything's possible, even when we closed the deal, most of the time you close the deal, it takes a long time. We closed the deal in October, and at that time, October, November, December, 70% of liquor sales per year were happening. So we were like, well, we want to launch now. And Diageo was huge, multinational. They were like, well, it takes a long time. You got to do a plan. This is a supplier. But yeah.
Okay.
And they're like, oh, usually we do 14 weeks of planning. We're like, no, we want to launch now. So we're like, we go, we shoot a video. Kanye West's song, Flashing Lights, had just come out. And it was like, in the beginning, like, this is going to be hot. I'm going to negotiate with them and make that song for the commercial. And they were astounded. We were like, in 3 weeks, full campaign, every market we wanted to go to, point of sale, merch, new commercial, fly hit song, radio plan order with the four. And they were just were like, yo, you guys move like ninjas.
Yeah.
And we were like,
three weeks.
We don't have other brands. Like, you know what I'm saying? He was successful, but I'm not going to get rotated to the Johnny Walker team. Like, we build stuff our life. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is, we're going to make this work.
It was a startup culture in a giant
It was a startup company. Culture in a medium size. We had like 200 people. And on this business, there was like 30 people at most. At that point, it was like six people in the first year. moving it forward. But we
and
moved
you were
with
four
the
of
urgency.
Those people.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that we knew out the gate, we were hearing from the markets that even to this day, you can ask the shippers, they're like, we've never seen anything like that, like how fast it was coming off shelves in the beginning.
So where do you go from there? When you have an explosive launch, how do you continue to grow from there when you're already overcoming every projection that you made?
Yeah, it's the trickiest thing in the world, right? Because you can set up a situation where you teach your consumer to be driven by excitement.
Yeah.
And it's hard to maintain a steady drum of excitement, right? Mm-hmm. So we continue to grow and scale the activity just at a larger level, but we really never backed away from the frequency of touch points. So at some point, we were a small group, like some 30 people. We were doing like 2,000 events a year. So for 30 people, that's a lot, right? You know what I mean? And some of it was natural because we had our own music artist and our label.
Yeah, sure.
Puff himself did so many things, right? But it's a lot of activity. And in order to grow it, we expanded the portfolio, but we also try to continually expand the audience, right, from an invitation standpoint. And then we also expanded geographically, right? So in the beginning, we were focused on certain markets, and then we went to full kind of U.S.
Was that the go-to-market strategy? Was events, events, events?
It was a lot of content. We were early, like with... things that are gone now, but we're very early with Foursquare. We were very early with Twitter. We used to be able to organically, the things we would get done in Twitter, we would see like Tide spending $1 million, but we would very much understand, okay, I know these 100 people are important and well-believed. And if they like the product and they're willing to go out, remember, this is very different.
Underpriced
so now,
attention.
Every influencer marketing wasn't a thing at this time.
Yeah. Now
we were calling our own people that were influencers and being
it.
Like, do you like it? We want to, but we also make sure they were taken care of. Like, I see you have a movie coming out. How can we support your release? But also, can you do this? I see you have a song coming out. You have a fashion line. And we really try to take care of behind the scenes. In New York, during Fashion Week, the houses are like nuts. Like they don't sleep. They're up for days. So we would do things like just show up with like delicious food and say, thanks for what you're doing for Fashion Week. Like those kind of behind the scenes things are the things that, you know, people remember from your hearts. We used to do things like most spirits brands go into a nightclub in the beginning of the night, right? Because you want to teach people to don't forget to tell people to buy Ciroc. We would do something. It was like a breakfast club program. We would come in at the end of the night with delicious breakfast they could take with them home, or they could eat it right there to say, thank you, cocktail waitress, for helping us tonight. And that, I think that behind the scenes feeling, we got a lot of goodwill for
that. It's more like rewarding already done good behavior rather than trying to get somebody to do something for you.
Yeah, everything's right. We try not to be transactional.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it lasted.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, cool. So Ciroc, you run this company for a decade?
Yeah, pretty much. So I started off, I had the conversation with him. I ran the agency. I got promoted to them. Then we bought it to Tequila. So I ran both of those brands for a little while. And then
tell me how the marketing agency intertwines with all of this. What was it like? How does that fit in with Ciroc and Tequila and all?
Yeah. So we had a deal where our side led really the branding and the marketing, right? So this agency that I built was called Blue Flame, and he had a previous agency called Blue Flame, but it had gone to really no one. And then we re-resurrected it. Was the key group that worked with our partner Diageo on how are we going to brand it, what commercials, what are we going to shoot, how are we going to show up in stores, etc.
Were they separate companies, like Ciroc, Blue Flame?
Yeah,
separate.
So Blue Flame was underneath Combs Enterprises, and then it was like a strategic alliance with Diageo, who was the biggest supplier in the world, who they would like
to
negotiate glass. Yeah, we were basically partners.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I eventually became the first. Besides Puff, the first president of Combs Enterprises largely. So that included, I was part of the team that built the television network. That included anything on the fashion lines. That included publishing on the music side and everything entirely.
How do you, like your first day in on that type of a position compared to what you'd been doing previously, what do you do?
Well, you know, it was similar to when, it was the exact same feeling I had from when I started Blue Flame. I started Blue Flame because we all do this. You work in an organization, you work in your you know, whatever. You're in the warehouse and you're like, oh, that team over in accounting, they could be doing this. So I was like, I tried to think about all the things that I felt like I thought I could improve on and
some
say,
bottlenecks
how
that you experienced.
How do I build this team to be the future, like the future of what we can be, right? To model the example of how we can be our best, the right systems, the right rewards, that make sure people really feel motivated, really participate, right? And that's the same blueprint I took when we said we're going to start building Combs Enterprises. One of the most interesting things was because I started as an executive assistant, when it was announced, I don't know why that didn't occur to me, but Puff made the announcement to the company and then, you know, we were all, yay, and I went to my office and it was like a line of the current assistants into my office, like crying, like Like, you know what I mean? Like, just saying, like, what a, like, that you, you know, we really do promote from within. And, you know, Puff was an intern and Audrey, like, everybody was a little bit of the spirit of the organization.
Yeah.
And that, like, I can still get chills. Like, more than anything else that day, I'll never forget, like, how That's much awesome. It meant to them. Really, in many ways, more than it meant to me.
Yeah. To show the path is real.
It's real. It's real, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, this happened for somebody. It could happen for me, too.
Yeah. It was really, it was really nice.
That's awesome. Okay. So you're running an organization like this now. How many people are in that organization now?
At that point, like time? Maybe like 250.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, 250. But like a dozen divisions, right? Like super lean, mean teams.
Super lean.
You got,
most people either in television network or working on Ciroc. Okay. And then you had small teams on like publishing.
So Ciroc
fashion,
became
and so
like
forth.
The flagship of the 1,000%. Entire enterprise.
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha. How did the tequila go with when you guys got into that business?
So tequila was fine. It was probably a little bit ahead of its time. Now, in the last couple of years, it's doing well. My understanding is I think it does over 100,000 cases, which is pretty big in this industry, but it was slow to get there. You know, funnily, one of the things...
It's Ciroc tequila?
No, it's called De Leon.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
It's
gotcha.
Called De Leon. Yeah.
I've heard of that one.
Yeah.
Okay. So that leads us now to the venture you're working on now.
Yeah.
So Lobos. Yes. Talk to me about Lobos. Yeah, what was the transition? What finally made you leave the Diddy empire to go do something different?
I think, like as I said in the beginning, I love learning. And I came there as an executive assistant. I did, I don't know, 7 roles in between there across a million genres. And I got to a point where I was like, I think I learned. I was like, I feel like I graduated. You know what I mean? So I was like, the music industry is notorious for people. Not that I was so just in the music industry, but I saw the example of people couldn't, the succession planning was like somebody dies. So there was no like encouraging of like, okay, let's make a pipeline for the next generation. I was like, I got it. I'm going to go and let's make room to bring the next generation in and I could go do something even more entrepreneurial, la di da. So Lobos came about, a gentleman, a legend actually, named Paul Wachter, had reached out to me about this incredible liquid. Our founder's name is Diego Osorio. He's out of Spain. And LeBron James separately at one point was like, I love tequila. That's my drink of choice. I'm thinking about getting into it. Paul basically connected them and LeBron fell in love with the tequila, with the liquid, which ours are all finished in sherry cask. And it's so many awards, like incredible. But nicely, our founder, Diego, who had done like 326 iterations of this liquid, but he was making it for like, he was like, I just want the best for my family and friends. He's like old school craftsman. I have so much respect for people who just care deeply about their outputs. And he's like that kind of guy. But he built it like, I'm going to be in Spain. I'm going to have like, you know, some of the restaurants I know around here. It's going to be fun. It's going to be local and passion.
Total passion.
Total cool thing. Total passion project. LeBron's like, so he says, LeBron, like, this is great. And actually, the reason why LeBron even gets involved is he was like, I did it for 2 years. I spent all my own money. So I was like, I should get a couple of investors. And he happened to like kind of, you know, travel in these circles. So LeBron's like, this liquid's incredible. I'm all in. I'm writing a check right now. And Diego, this is going to be great. It's going to be great for us. So LeBron was like, no, we're going to take over the world. Paul was like, we're going to need a CEO.
It doesn't seem like he does much halfway.
It's not his style. Yeah. So they called and I met. I got a chance to meet Diego and some of the team. Fell in love with the liquid.
So Paul is the one who
called me. Yeah, okay. Paul. And then introduced me to the founder, Diego Osorio. And
tried the tequila.
Because to the point you said earlier, my thing was like, look, after Ciroc, I'm very grateful, but I get like 50 pitches a week on sort of stuff, right? I was like, I don't have any interest in doing anything that's not incredible.
Yeah.
So he was telling me, I was like, I have so much respect for LeBron and I think Arnold Schwarzenegger. We have a crazy cap table. Paris Hilton, Drake, everybody has invested in this brand.
No shit. Yeah. I didn't know that.
But I was like, I don't care. Unless the liquid
is
good.
I still can't sell shit products.
I still can't sell, right? So he pulled it out. It's funny. We were in New York at 57th Street in the cocktail area of the Four Seasons. Like almost got kicked out because he's like pulls it out in a glass. but I try it and I'm like, money. Sign me up. Like anything at this level of quality and his just commitment and
was
integrity.
Was it a particular bottle or a type of tequila?
Yeah. So
you tried?
We have, at the time, I had tried the Hoven, which was incredible. And then we had ended up adding a Reposado, which we beat like hundreds of other in San Francisco, which is like the Oscars of the spirits industry. And we also have an Añejo, an extra Añejo, and a Mezcal right now.
Okay.
As a full lineup.
Real quick before we move on.
Yeah.
What is the difference between tequila and mezcal?
It's a great question. So the biggest difference really is the mezcal is like, we always say it's kind of like the wild rock and roll side. Like it's really authentic. It's the volcanic pits and the way that it's made, typically made around Oaxaca in Mexico. And it's like when you see the pictures of like donkeys going through that dark, rich soil, that because of that volcanic pit where it comes from, you get this smokiness on the liquid, like, right? Yeah. Some of them I feel like, I think do a disservice to the category. You get the wrong, if you try the wrong mezcal first, you may think to yourself, like, oh, it's like looking at a barbecue grill, I'll pass. Mm-hmm. But if you try the right one, and I love ours. I love Lobos because of the sherry finish makes it a little easier on the palate and more mixable.
Yeah.
But I shout out to Illegal. There are great brands, but you have to pick the right one. It's a little smokier. It's a great transition. If you are like a single malt drinker, but you want something a little more clean, a little lighter, a little lower in calories, then a mezcal is a nice option.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's, I didn't even know that there was like, I didn't even know that they were like from the same family until like
a year ago. Absolutely. There's so many agave, like I think there's, people don't know about this Bacanora's Rasi. There's just so many different agave spirits and that I think we're going to see roll out over the next few days.
I've not tried, do you drink the mezcal just like straight or on the rocks? Or
You can. It's great like in a Paloma. Okay. You could do like a mezcal old fashioned. It's really good if you like an old fashioned cocktail.
Yeah. I'm a big whiskey drinker most of the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So if you are, you could probably do on a rock with a lime.
Yeah, but I frankly drink tequila now more just because it's healthier.
Yeah.
I know that, I mean, alcohol is alcohol. It's, you know, not super healthy either way, but I do like drink tequila more now than probably anything else just because of that one thing.
Well,
I miss the flavor profile of the whiskey. So maybe.
Oh, well, our extra añejo, we find that like real whiskey enthusiasts respond the most to, because it kind of has like a beautiful journey when you're drinking the liquid.
Okay.
But I will get you everything and then you let me know what you think.
Sweet.
Yeah, super clean. It's kosher. No additives.
Taste test
terrific
for you.
There you go. I love that.
How's it been working with like more celebrity brands for you? Like it seems like you do really well pairing with people who have kind of this passion in this thing, and then you can kind of jump in and just be like, all right, give me the reins and let's go, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we would love to not, we have all these celebrities behind it, but they are legitimate investors. So it's a little different in that for us, we say for Lobos, our star is really the liquid, right? That's actually the liquid. And we're grateful to be able to get to the audience, you know, through LeBron.
Sure.
But the story of Lobos is all around the liquid.
Certainly helps
distribution. And all around really Diego. Yeah. I always joke, like, we have a founder that speaks Spanish. Like a lot of times.
Fair.
It's kind of crazy. You know what I mean? Like, Diego's family has been in the industry since the 1700s. Like, whole story, everything on that bottle. The reason why it's called Lobos is those two wolves. It's his family's coat of arms from the 1700s. So, with all respect to all the brands that are out, what I love about this story is that we just tell the truth all day long. And I think today's consumer responds to like, oh, I love real storytelling.
So much easier to market, you know what I mean? Truth.
So much easier to market and remember at this point, the truth. And people recognize it. They do. They respond differently of like, oh, this is like his real family. Like we run it like a family business. It's just different.
Cool. Has there been like differences for you in terms of like working with different personalities in that world? Like working closely with Diddy versus working closely with LeBron? Obviously big personalities who have different expertises and probably bring different assets to the table. Was it kind of a weird transition after working with someone like Diddy for as long as you did to move in and work with somebody else who also has this big personality?
I mean, look, I think the idea of what they have in common, and it is, and you know, fortunately, I've been fortunate to work with a lot of luminaries and notables. What they do have in common is like an extraordinary work ethic, right? So I think that was the perfect training ground to work with anybody. So it's a little bit less like these extraordinary kind of, you know, once in a century type of work ethics. That's what's more interesting to me, whether they were, what they could have been like the most incredible architect or, you know what I mean? Or diver. But is that like, oh my gosh, that dedication and commitment to work, that is interesting to me.
For sure.
Generally, having worked with a lot of musicians, and now working with more athletes, because we also have, you know, Draymond and other athletes on Capitol. What I have seen, and don't judge me, musicians, is the discipline, I think, that comes with being an athlete. And especially you're in NBA, you're playing a gazillion games, you know to show up, you know, super respect to LeBron. When we do anything for this, he's read everything in advance. He's early. He has meaningful contributions. He cares about the economics of the business. Right. He's such a gentleman. Like I have a lot of regard for the person he is.
Yeah.
Very much disaggregated from his celebrity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just his career speaks volumes about his discipline and dedication to the sport.
Yeah.
Like, it just is incredible that he's doing the things
it's
that he's doing.
It's just different than a rock and roll, which you get like super creative, incredible, these like pop moments of the rock and roll thing, but it's that rock and roll lifestyle. It's very different than the discipline of an athlete.
Yeah. Yeah, this has been an incredible conversation. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you.
I've had hundreds of people on the show at this point, and this is one question that I've asked almost all of them. So I'm curious to hear how you're going to answer it. Who you know or what you know, which of those two do you think is the more important asset in life and why?
It's a great question. I would say, what you know, because who you know is incredibly important, but I don't know that it sustains you. I think who you know can make great pops and you can pop out and get incredible stuff. And that's how the world works.
Yeah.
But at some point, what you know is going to kick in some way, whether it's legit, like survival. So, I mean, I do think for your own self-confidence, like we talked about, I have a 10-year-old, we talked about children, right? And I think when you look at like almost Montessori type models and like the idea that you feel better about yourself when you know you can take care of yourself. And when you know you can take care of yourself, that's because of what you know, not who you know. There's plenty of person who knows a lot of amazing people, but they actually don't sleep soundly at night and they're actually sad and miserable. You know what I mean? But if you know, like, nah, throw me in the forest, I'm gonna be okay. Because of what I know, I just think you actually have a happier life. And to me, who you know might get you more money. I think what you know gets you a more satisfying life.
Great answer. Great answer. Can't be mad at it. Dia, thank you so much for coming
to the show. Thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure talking with you. Hopefully we can do a part two sometime.
Yes, heck yeah.
Thanks so
thank
much.
You.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks for spending some time with me and my friends. If you want to be better friends with me, then head over to travischappell.com/team to subscribe to my free newsletter, Your Friend Travis, where I share what's on my mind about life, building a business, raising kids, being married, and anything else I would normally share with my close circle of friends. That's travischappell.com/team. And my biggest ask of you, since I'm sharing my friends with you, is to share this episode with a friend of yours that hasn't listened to the show yet. Then leave us a quick 5-star rating in Apple Podcasts and in Spotify. It would mean the world to us as it helps us make sure that this show continues to be more valuable to you. Thanks in advance, and I'll catch you on the next episode.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.